Good afternoon, everybody. School Plotter coming at you live from my house. It's GMS, Gulfman Synagogue Book Club class time. Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock we meet, and we are currently reading Kol Dodi Dofeik, Listen, My Beloved Knocks, by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. We have concluded four chapters. The last one was a doozy, where he goes through the six knocks that the Almighty has been knocking on our door, the door of the Jewish people. And now we're going to continue in the little book over here. It's only about 100 pages long. And now we're going to see chapter 5 and hopefully even chapter 6. Chapter 5 starts on page 43, the obligation of Torah Judaism to the land of Israel. What was our reaction to the beckoning of the voice of the beloved, meaning God, to the munificence of his loving kindness and miracles? Did we get out of our beds and immediately open the door? Or did we continue to rest like the lover in Shir HaShirim, in the Song of Songs? And were we too lazy to get out of our beds? I have washed my feet. How shall I soil them? Song of Songs, chapter 5, verse 3. All the trembling and fear for the geographical integrity of the state of Israel, all the suggestions of our enemies, which are directed at territorial concessions by the state of Israel, and all the brazen demands of the Arabs for boundary changes are based on only one fact. The Jews have not populated the Negev and established hundreds of settlements there. Had the Negev been settled with hundreds of thousands of Jews, even Nasser would never have dreamed of the possibility of rending it from the state of Israel. Wide and unpopulated expanses constantly and perpetually endanger the tranquility of the state. The Torah has already emphasized this notion when it states, you shall not be allowed to quickly destroy them so that the wild animals will not overwhelm you. See Exodus 23. The fact that the Jews have conquered the Negev is not enough. Its settlement is what is important. The great sage Maimonides ruled that the first sanctification of the land of Israel was not a lasting one because it was the result of a military conquest, which was annulled by the violent attack of an enemy whose army was vast and armaments numerous, who conquered the land and took it from us. The second sanctification of the land, which was carried out through occupation and settlement, by divine sanction, through toil and sweat, was never annulled. That, of course, was that of Daniel and Nehemiah, Ezra and Nehemiah specifically, rather, Ezra and Nehemiah, when they returned back from Babylonia and they began the redevelopment of the land of Israel and the rebuilding of the Second Temple. Yes, actually, the Second Temple, right? Second Temple, Ezra and Nehemiah. And that, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, it's that settlement by Ezra and Nehemiah, which lasts the test of time, and it's going to be for all time. The sanctification land of Israel was not officially lost lovo forever and ever as a result of Joshua and his conquest of the land by the military. Rather, it was done by the sweat and brow of Ezra and Nehemiah and those Jews who returned. They were the ones who helped sanctify the land of Israel forever. The second sanctification of the land, which was carried out through occupation and settlement by divine sanction, through toil and sweat, was never annulled. The sanctity that is based on the settlement of the land is simply stated for now and for all time. We are terribly guilty for this gross negligence. American Jewry, remember he's speaking in 1956, American Jewry could have certainly accelerated the process of colonization. Yet why should we examine the faults of others and place the responsibility on the shoulders of non-observant Jews? Let us admit our own faults and confess to our own derelictions. Among the Jews of America, Orthodox Jews bear the most blame for the slow pace of the conquest of the land through settlement. It was for us, the loyalists of Judaism, to heed the call of the beloved more acutely and to respond to it immediately with extraordinary effort in commenting on the verse, quote, "And I shall lay desolate the land." Leviticus 26, Rashi states in the name of Medrash Toras Kohanim, quote, "This is a boon to Israel." The fact that God says he's going to lay desolate the land, that is a merit, that is a blessing, that's a great thing for Israel, that its enemies will not find tranquility in its land when it shall be bereft of its true inhabitants. End quote of that Midrash and Rashi. The land of Israel cannot be built by any other nation or people. Top 45. Only the Jewish people have it within their power to settle the land and make its desolation blossom. The Creator's promise was turned into a wondrous reality in different periods in the annals of the history of the land of Israel. We cannot forget even for a moment that the land of Israel, like a magnet, attracted the nations of the world, both Christians and Muslims. The Crusades in the Middle Ages were undertaken with the purpose of conquering the land of Israel and populating it with Christians. All the toil of the Crusaders was for naught. They did not strike roots in the land. Even the indigenous Muslims did not succeed in properly settling the land. It remained a barren desert, as it is said in Leviticus 26, quote, "And your land shall become a desolation," end quote. Even in modern times, when European nations in the 17th and 18th centuries settled and populated entire continents, the land of Israel remained desolate and in a more primitive state than its neighboring Arab lands, Egypt, Syria, and the Lebanon. It's true. I think we've said many times when Mark Twain went there, mid-1800s. He couldn't believe it. So what is this? There's nothing going on over here. This place is like dead. It's dead. There are a couple of Jews here, Muslims over there, Christians over here. I mean, obviously people are living in the land, and nobody's denying that. But there weren't that many, and nothing was happening. It was like, you know, very quiet, and maybe if you had a little farm, you had a farm. But there was no great development whatsoever. There was no ability to, you know, allow for an influx of people in large numbers. I mean, there was no – did they have hospitals? Very primitive if they had. Did they have malaria? They sure did. They had ponds and lakes that had to get drained, we're told. Were there roads? Not very good ones. And it took the secular Zionists to go in there and start developing the whole land. And then the Arabs go, "Oh, my God. That's our land you're tampering with. That's our land. Huh? What were you doing for centuries with it?" Nothing. It was sitting around smoking, sitting around drinking coffee, sitting around talking, you know, talking about how unfair life is. That's what Arabs do. So the Crusaders got nothing. They did nothing. They left a little bit of an imprint in the land. You go to Jerusalem, you'll find certain things. No doubt about that. But for the most part, it was 200 years. And when they were kicked out by the Muslims, it was almost as if the Crusaders had never actually even been there. With the exception of these certain touristy things, or maybe a building here they put up and a building there they put up, but that's nothing with nothing. Muslims, even the indigenous Muslims, did not succeed in properly settling the land. It remained a barren desert, as is said, quote, "And your land shall become a desolation," Leviticus 26. Even in modern times, when European nations in the 17th and 18th centuries, I read it, settled and populated an entire continent, the land of Israel remained desolate and in a more primitive state than its neighboring Arab lands, Egypt, Syria, and the Lebanon. Had the land been settled by an industrious, successful, and cultured people, had the land been properly populated and developed, our attachment to it would have been eroded by the course of events, and no Jewish foot would have trod upon it. That's what he's saying. If the Muslims were to come in and really develop the land, if the Christians, when they were around, if they would have really developed the land and fought off the Muslims, or even if the Muslims take over and they bring fruits and vegetables to market, they develop farmlands and all kinds of advanced farming techniques, and they start settling people and building buildings and apartment buildings and private homes and hotels and whatever, and whatever it is that it takes for society to function. Had they done that, had they been successful doing that, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, our attachment to it would have been eroded by the course of events, and no Jewish foot would have trod upon it. Strangers would have eaten its bounty and its fruit, and our rights would have become null and void. However, the land of Israel did not betray the Jewish people. It was loyal to them, awaiting redemption throughout the years. Top 46. Logic dictates, then, that when the Jewish community was given the opportunity to return to its land, which had withheld its treasures from foreigners and stored them for us, Orthodox Jews should have hastened to perform so great a mitzvah, to plunge with joy and enthusiasm into the very midst of this holy work, the building and settling of the land. However, to our regret, we have not reacted that way. When the, quote, desolate one, which longingly waited for us from era to era, invited us to come and redeem her from her desolation for almost 1,900 years. Sorry. Again, when the desolate one, meaning Israel, the land of Israel, which longingly waited for us from era to era, which invited us to come and redeem her from her desolation. And when the beloved, meaning God, who watched over the desolation for almost 1,900 years and decreed that during this time no tree should grow and no well should fructify the land, when the beloved beckoned at the door of the lover, lover meaning the nation of Israel, we, the Orthodox Jews, the lover, did not bestir ourselves from our beds to open the door for our beloved. If we had contiguous settlements throughout the land from Eilat to Dan, our situation would be very different. Let us publicly and frankly confess. We complain about certain Israeli leaders and their attitude toward the values of our tradition and religious practice. The complaints are justified. We have serious charges against the secular leadership of the land of Israel. However, are only they to be blamed? And are we as faultless and pure as the heavenly angels? Such an assumption is without foundation. We could have extended our influence and done something to shape the spiritual character of the land if we had but hurried to awaken from our slumber and open the door for the beloved who is knocking. I fear that we Orthodox Jews are still enveloped in sweet slumber. Top 47. If we were to establish more religious kibbutzim, if we were to build more housing for religious immigrants, if we were to establish an extensive system of schools, our situation would be completely different. Then there would be no need to come forward with complaints against the leaders of other movements. We Orthodox Jews suffer from a unique illness that is not found in irreligious Jews, with some rare exceptions. We are all miserly. We do not excel when it comes to giving generously in comparison with the rest of American Jewry. We are satisfied to part with a couple of pennies, and we demand, in recompense for our piddling donation, our reward in this world, and a share in the first allocations. Thus, our dignity has reached its nadir, and we do not exercise appropriate influence on Jewish life here in America and on the course of events in Israel. Great and free America is a land of charity. The government itself, in the years 1945 to 1956, dispersed $55 billion, $350 million in foreign aid projects. The numbers are truly beyond our comprehension. And philanthropists are truly respected in this land that knows how to give and help in such proportions. Accordingly, we Orthodox Jews are not entitled to the greatness that others possess. Lately, we have become experts at criticism and fault finding. See Leviticus 13. And the priest shall look on him and pronounce him unclean. We know well how to criticize, to look for blemishes, and to express opinions as self-styled experts. One thing, however, escapes us, and that is that the priest who pronounces defilement must leave the encampment to be with the afflicted sufferer so as to purify him. Quote, and the priest shall leave the encampment, and the priest shall command. See Leviticus 14. We must build not just a few small nooks whose impact is unfelt, but central institutions throughout the length and breadth of America and the land of Israel. We have an obligation to purify those who are outside the encampments, who are situated in the huge camp of ignorance. To this end, there is a need for vast sums, and we, the Orthodox Jews, are far from being generous and charitable. For this reason, our institutions here and in Israel suffer from want. The religious Zionist movement especially has to content itself with paltry sums. Due to lack of funds, the movement cannot function appropriately. Indeed, the loyal lover is quite splendid. Her eyes are like twin doves, and her face radiates a beautiful charm. The Song of Songs, chapter 1 and chapter 4. She is much fairer than the irreligious lover. However, beauty is vain and grace is deceptive. Sheker Achein, Hevel Ayofi. She is much fairer than the irreligious lover. However, beauty is vain and grace is deceptive. See Proverbs 31. If this lover is stingy and very lazy, I have removed my cloak. How shall I put it on again? Song of Songs, chapter 5. When one calls a rich Jew and asks him to give to a just cause, he answers, quote, I am going to Florida, and this year I have decided to stay in a luxury hotel, and I don't have the wherewithal to give you what you request. What did the scholar tell the king of the Khazars in the Khazari? Quote, you have embarrassed me, O king of Khazars, and our saying, worship at his holy hill. Psalm 99, verse 9, is but the chirping of a starling. See the Khazari, chapter 2, subsection 24. Do we not hear in our trembling over the safety and tranquility of the land of Israel in our day? Don't we hear the beckoning of the beloved who begs the lover to let him in? He has already been beckoning for 8 years, and still he has not been properly responded to. Nonetheless, he continues to beckon. To our good fortune, our inherited land has become more beautiful. The beloved has not shown the lover any favoritism, but he has shown compassion for her. The beloved beckoned for only a short moment that night and disappeared. Yet with us, he has exhibited extraordinary patience. It is 8 years that he has continued to beckon. Hopefully, we will not miss the opportunity. Top page 51, chapter 6. We'll do chapter 6 and call it a day. The covenants of Sinai and Egypt. When we delve into our historical existence, we come to an important realization regarding our Weltanschauung, a German word meaning Hashkafat Olam, world outlook. When we delve into our historical existence, we come to an important realization regarding our world outlook. The Torah relates that the Holy One concluded two covenants with Israel, two treaties with Israel. One covenant was made in Egypt. Quote, and I shall take you unto me for a people, and I will be to you God. See Exodus 6. The second covenant was at Mount Sinai. And Moses took the book of the covenant, and he said, behold, the blood of the covenant, which the Almighty made with you, in agreement with all these words. Exodus 24. The third covenant in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 28, is identical in content and purpose to the covenant of Sinai. What is the essence of these two covenants, Sinai and Egypt, or in their proper order, Egypt and Sinai? It appears to me that this question was already answered at the beginning of our essay. Just as Judaism distinguished fate from destiny in the realm of personal individuality, so it also differentiated between these two concepts, fate and destiny, in the sphere of our national historical existence. The individual is tethered to his nation with bonds of fate and chains of destiny. In accordance with this postulate, one can say that the covenant of Egypt was a covenant of fate, and the covenant of Sinai was one of destiny. Top 52. What is the covenant of fate? Fate signifies in the life of the nation, as it does in the life of the individual, an existence of compulsion. A strange force merges all individuals into one unit. The individual is subject and subjugated against his will to the national fate slash existence. And it's impossible for him to avoid it and be absorbed into a different reality. The environment expels the Jew who flees from the presence of God so that he is awakened from his slumber like Jonah the prophet who awoke to the voice of the ship's captain demanding to know his personal national religious identity. The historical loneliness of the Jew percolates from a feeling of compulsive fate. He is as alone in his life on earth as in his death. The concept of Kever Yisrael, proper Jewish burial, emphasizes the Jew's strange detachment from the world. Sociologists and psychologists may say what they wish about the inexplicable isolation of a Jew. Their explanations are nothing more than barren speculation, incapable of rationally describing the phenomenon. Jewish separateness belongs to the framework of the covenant of fate that was concluded in Egypt. In truth, Judaism and withdrawal from the world are synonymous. Even before the exile in Egypt, separateness descended upon our world with the appearance of the first Jew, our father Abraham, Avraham HaIvri, who lived apart. See Bereishis Rabbah 42. The whole world was on one side, and he was an Aver. He was on the other side. Balaam, when he gazed upon the Israelite camp, understood the wonder of the experience of Jewish separateness, and he proclaimed with amazement, Ki Mirosh Tzurim Erenu, Umigvaos Ashurenu, Henam Levadad Yishkon, Uvagoyim Lo Yitzchashav. I see this nation from mountaintops, and I gaze on it from the heights. It's a nation dwelling alone, at peace, not counting itself among other nations. Even if a Jew, and Shreki made a great song on that, sings a great song. Even if a Jew reaches the pinnacle of social and political accomplishment, he will not be able to free himself from the chains of isolation. Paradoxical fate watches over the isolation and uniqueness of the Jew, despite his apparent integration into his non-Jewish environment. Even people of power and authority like Yosef, the regent of Egypt, was separated from Egyptian society and remained alone in his tent. Quote, they served him by himself. I mean, they served Yosef by himself. And for the Egyptians, by themselves. See Genesis 43. Egyptians could not eat with the Hebrews because it was a taboo thing for them. It was a taboo for them. Before his death, Joseph pleaded with his brothers, when God will surely remember you and bring you out of this land, you shall carry up my bones from here. Genesis 50. For despite my greatness and glory, I am tied to you and your existence, both in life and in death. This singular, inexplicable phenomenon of the individual clinging to the community and feeling alienated from the outside world was forged and formed in Egypt. There, Israel was elevated to the status of a nation in the sense of a unity from which arises uniqueness as well. The awareness of the fate covenant in all of its manifestations is an integral part of our historical metaphysical essence. When the exclusive fate-driven individual stands face-to-face with God, he encounters the God of the Jews, who is revealed to man by the experience of loneliness and from the inexorability of existence, from the fate awareness that overcomes and subjugates man. He is the Almighty who does not wait for the supplications of man and his voluntary summons. He imposes his sovereignty upon him against his will. A Jew cannot banish the God of the Jews from his world. Even if he desecrates his Shabbat, defiles his table and his bed, and tries to deny his identity, he will not escape the dominion of the God of the Jews, which follows him like a shadow. So long as a person's physiognomy testifies to his birth, So long as Jewish blood flows in his veins, and so long as his flesh is Jewish, he is compelled to serve the God of the Hebrews. There is no counsel or tactic that can oppose God. Even if the Jew who spurns his people should soar to the farthest heavens, from there the hand of the God of the Hebrews shall reach him. Where shall the Jew go to flee the God of the Hebrews? And where can he escape from God's presence? Exodus 5, they said, the God of the Hebrews has revealed himself to us. Please allow us to take a 3-day journey into the desert, and we shall deliver sacrifices unto God, lest he smite us with pestilence or sword. End quote. Failure to cleave to the demands, top page 55. Failure to cleave to the commands of the God of the Hebrews results in punishment and the destruction of existence. The covenant of fate is also expressed in positive categories that stem from the awareness of shared fate. There are four facets to this rare state of mind. First, the awareness of shared fate appears as that of shared experience. We are all in the realm of a shared fate that binds together the different strata of the nation and does not discriminate between classes and individuals. Fate does not distinguish between nobility and common folk, between rich and poor, between a prince dressed in royal purple velvet and a poor man who goes begging from door to door, between a pious Jew and an assimilationist. Even though we may speak a mix of different languages, even if we are citizens of different lands, even if we look different, one being short and black, the other tall and blonde, even if we live in different economic systems and under different living conditions, the one living in a royal palace, the other in a humble cave, we have but one fate. When the Jew in the cave is attacked, the security of the Jew standing in the courtyard of the king is jeopardized. To quote, do not think in your soul that you from all the Jews will escape and shall flee to the palace of the king, Mordecai said to Esther. See Esther chapter 4. Queen Esther, robed in majesty, and Mordecai wearing sackcloth, were situated in the same historical nexus. All Israel are bound together. Kol Yisrael Aravim Zebazer, Talmud Bavli Sota 37a. We are all persecuted, or we are all saved together. Top 56. Second, the awareness of shared historical experience leads to the experience of shared suffering. A feeling of empathy is a basic fact in the consciousness of shared Jewish fate. The suffering of one segment of the nation is the lot of the entire community. The scattered and separated people mourns and is consoled together. Prayer, the cry, and the consolation were formulated, as I emphasized above, in the plural. Supplications that emerge from the depths of travail are not confined to the suffering and affliction of the groaning individual. They encompass the needs of the entire community. When there is a sick person in one's home, one prays not only for that person, but for all the sick of Israel. When one enters the house of a mourner to comfort him and to wipe the tear from the bereaved, sad face, he directs his words of condolence to, quote, all the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem, Hamakim Menachem Eschem B'soch Shar Avele Tzion V'Yerushalayim. When there's a sick person in one's house, one prays not only for that person, but for all the sick of Israel. When one enters the house of a mourner to comfort him and to wipe the tear from the bereaved, sad face, he directs his words of condolence to, quote, all the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. But he is directing it to those who are mourning Zion and Jerusalem. The slightest disturbance in the state of an individual or a sector of the people should trouble all segments of the nation throughout their dispersion. It is forbidden and it is impossible for the individual to isolate himself from his fellow and not participate in his suffering. If the assumption of shared historical experience is accurate, then shared suffering is its direct corollary. Top page 57. One of the great preachers of the last generation put it well when he likened the people of Israel to the two-headed son about whom it was asked in the Talmud whether he would, as a dual personality, take two shares of his familial inheritance or only one portion. What should one do with a two-headed being? Does he get double or does he get single? So too one may ask, has the dispersal of the nation in the diaspora and it's taking root in different surroundings caused its spiritual disintegration, or has the unity of the people not been lost despite the fact that it has grown many heads and speaks many languages with different customs and diverse ways of life? In a word, is the Jewish diaspora one or is it two? The answer, continued the preacher, to the question of the unity of the people is identical with the decision rendered in the Beis Medrash. To the litigant who asked about the status of the two-headed heir. Okay, again, let me read that again. The answer, continued the preacher, to the question of the unity of the people is identical with the decision rendered in the study hall to the litigant who asked about the status of the two-headed heir. Let them pour boiling water on the head of the one, said the rabbi, and let's see the other's reaction. If the other screams in pain, then the two comprise one personality, and they shall receive one share of the inheritance. However, if the second one does not feel the suffering of the first, then they are two individuals enfolded in one body, and they shall receive two shares of the estate. With respect to the unity of the nation as well, one must firmly establish that so long as there is shared suffering, in the sense of, quote, I am with him, Imo Anochi Batsara, I am with him in his distress. See Psalm 91, verse 15, top page 58. Then there's unity. If I am with him when he's in distress, if there's unity in the nation, if I am with him in his distress, meaning over here, not God, although God is speaking, I think, in that pasuk, but it means if a fellow Jew says, Imo Anochi Batsara, I am with him in his pain, then there's unity. Top page 58. If the Jew on whom providence has shined its countenance and who believes that with respect to himself, the sharpness of hatred has been removed and estrangement from his surroundings has passed, nevertheless, still feels the distress of the nation and the burden of its fate existence, then his bond to the nation has not been severed. If boiling water is poured on the head of a Moroccan Jew, the prim and proper Jew in Paris or London must scream, and by feeling the pain, shows himself loyal to the nation. The breakup of the people and the constriction of its self-image are the result of a lack of empathy. Third, shared suffering is expressed in a feeling of shared obligation and responsibility. When the children of Israel left Egypt, Moses and Aaron fell on their faces, pleaded before God, and said, God, Almighty God, God of hosts of all flesh, shall one man sin and you direct divine wrath at the entire congregation? See number 16. This prayer accomplished that which the shepherds of Israel sought. The Holy One agreed with their action and only punished Korach and his cohorts. However, God only demonstrated this loving kindness momentarily. Forever after, the eye is ensnared in the sin of his fellow. If he had it within his power to reprimand, admonish, and bring his neighbor to repentance. Let me read that again. The Holy One agreed with their action and only punished Korach and his cohorts. However, God only demonstrated this loving kindness momentarily. Forever after, the eye is ensnared in the sin of his fellow. If he had it within his power to reprimand and admonish and bring his neighbor to repentance. Then you should do that. You can't just let your neighbor just keep on fumbling around throughout the whole lifetime. That's not doing the neighbor any favor. You got to eventually sit down with the neighbor and talk brass tacks. What are you doing here on earth? Do you know why you're here? Here's what you should be doing. The people of Israel have a collective responsibility, both halachic and moral, for one another. The discrete units coalesce into a single halachic moral unity with one all-encompassing and normative conscience and consciousness. The halacha has already decreed that, quote, all Jews are sureties for one another. Such that one who has already fulfilled his personal mitzvah is not considered fully absolved thereby, and may therefore fulfill the obligation on behalf of others who have not yet as yet done so. The I is not exempt from its obligation so long as his neighbor has not fulfilled that which is incumbent upon the neighbor. There is a special covenant of mutual responsibility among the children of Israel. This covenant is expressed in the blessings and imprecations pronounced on Mounts Gerizim and Ebal. See Deuteronomy 11. It is based upon the notion of peoplehood revealed to Moshe in Egypt. Out of this concept grew the covenant of mutual obligation. Moshe, the dean of all prophets, in relating this covenant of mutual obligation, emphasized, quote, "For that he may establish you today unto him as a people, and he shall be unto you as a God." Deuteronomy 29. He thus returned to the formulation of the covenant of Egypt, "And I will take you to me as a people, and I will be your God." Exodus 6. Here the notion of shared fate was elevated from the plane of communal political suffering to that of halachic and moral responsibility. We are all sureties for one another, as it is said, and the revelations belonging to us and to our children forever. Deuteronomy 29. Sharing of responsibility is not simply a halachic speculative notion, but essential fact in the history of Israel's relations with other nations. Our neighbors perpetually blame us for the transgressions of our co-religionists, and they turn the Talmud's rhetorical question of, if Tobias sins, should Ziegler be whipped? They turn that into an everyday reality that no one questions. The identification, tab page 60, the identification of the activities of the individual with the deeds of the nation is a fundamental truth of the history of our people. Our enemies do not allow the individual Jew to remain alone in his own confines. They take him out of his own four cubits into the public domain, and there harshly criticize the entire community because of him. This standard is only employed in relation to Israel, and not with respect to other nations. No one has yet accused a Russian or a Chinese individual of being an agent of international communism and then held him liable by virtue of his national origin for the nations that lead the communist regime and aspire to subjugate the world under this cruel order. No one has yet accused a Russian or a Chinese individual of being an agent of communism and then holding him personally liable by virtue of his national origin for the nations that lead the communist regimes and aspire to subjugate the world under that cruel order known as communism. So far, he's never met a capitalist over there, whatever. And no one has ever accused a Russian or a Chinaman of that kind of behavior, but they will a Jew. In contrast to this logical and humane approach to the members of other nations, the Jewish people as a whole is slandered because of a handful of Jewish apostates, with the allegation that it is sympathetic to communism. We have yet to be absolved from this libel. 1956, he's speaking. But for decades and decades, who was running the Communist Party? Well, I was Karl Marx Jewish, maybe. And then came who? Engels. Ultimately, years later, you got Trotsky, the Jewish guy. And Stalin had a murder. Jewish people getting hooked up with communism. Unbelievable. Okay. We have yet to be absolved from this libel. One or two or three or 10 or 100 or 1,000 Jews are into communism, so therefore every Jew is a communist. Not at all true. Once again, the explanations of the experts for this phenomenon are not satisfactory. It makes no difference whether the causes are found in the realm of psychopathology or in the realm of social history. Scientific classification is beside the point. The phenomenon remains obscure and inaccessible. We Orthodox Jews have one solution to this riddle. The hand of the covenant of faith, which was concluded in Egypt on the basis of the absolute uniqueness of the nation, and is revealed amidst such an unintelligible reality. Let me read that again. We Orthodox Jews have one solution to this riddle. The hand of the covenant of faith, which was concluded in Egypt on the basis of the absolute uniqueness of the nation, is revealed amidst such an unintelligible reality. Top 61. The commandment to sanctify God's name and the prohibition against desecrating it are clear in light of the principle of shared responsibility and obligation. The activity of the individual is debited to the account of the many. Every wrong committed by an individual stains the name of Israel throughout the world. The individual is responsible not only for his own conscience, but also for the collective conscience of the nation, rotting on everybody's shoulders. If he conducts himself properly, he has sanctified the name of the nation and the name of the God of Israel. If he has sinned, he causes shame to befall the nation and consecrates its God. Sorry. If he has sinned, he causes shame to befall the nation and desecrates its God, not consecrates God. The opposite. He desecrates the God of Israel. Fourth, shared experience is expressed by cooperation. The experience to perform acts of charity, tzedakah, and loving kindness, chesed, is derived from the experience of unity that is so all-pervading and encompassing. When the Torah deals with these precepts, it uses the term brother, not reverend friend. And if your brother shall become impoverished, you shall support him, and he shall live among you. Leviticus 25. Do not harden your heart, and do not shut your hand against your needy brother. Open your hand to your poor and destitute brother in your land. Deuteronomy 15. Confrontation, top 62. Confrontation with the fateful reality of the nation in all of its strangeness instills the Jew with his common awareness in the realm of social activism, the shared situation of all Jews, whether in the objective realm as an event or in the subjective realm as suffering, taps the sources in the individual soul, taps the sources in the individual's soul for loving kindness and pity for his brethren who are in trouble, and that, in a roundabout way, touches him as well. Maimonides formulated this idea in his laconic but content-filled manner. Quote, all Jews and those attached to them are like brothers. As it is said, you are sons to the God your God. And if a brother will not show mercy to his brother, then who will have mercy on him? And to whom can the poor of Israel look for help? To those other nations who hate and persecute, they can look for help only to their brethren. From both the midst of a heritage which is compulsive and faithful, and a terrible loneliness, a terrible aloneness, which are the source of the unity of the nation, issues forth the attribute of loving kindness, which summons and drives the faithful collective to imbue their unity with positive content by means of the constant participation in events, suffering, consciousness, and acts of mutual assistance. Did you get that? Again, bears repeating, from both the midst of a heritage which is compulsive and faithful, and a terrible aloneness, which are the source of the unity of the nation, from all that issues forth the attribute of Ahavas Chesed, loving kindness, which summons and drives the faithful collective to imbue their unity with positive content by means of the constant participation in events, suffering, consciousness, and acts of mutual assistance. The isolated Jew finds his solace, top of 63, the isolated Jew finds his solace in his active adhesion to the whole, and by tearing down barriers of egotistical separatist existence, and by joining his neighbors. The oppressive experience of fate finds its connection in the coalescing of individual personal experiences into the new entity called a nation. The obligation of love for another person emanates from the self-awareness of the people of fate, which is alone and perplexed by its uniqueness. For this was the covenant of Egypt concluded. My dear friends, thank you so much for coming out and hearing the reading of Rabbi Soloveitchik's wonderful book, Kol Dodi Dofeik. Short book, but powerful, powerful. It's on fire in its honesty and its integrity. And I thank you for listening. And I wish you an excellent rest of the day, safe and secure. Do what you can to help the communities here in Cincinnati and in Ohio and in Israel, reaching out through our mishpacha or one mishpacha, helping out those who need help, who have been displaced because of the war in the state of Israel. Please do help our mishpacha or one mishpacha. Take a look at the emails from Gulf Manor Synagogue. And I think there's also a website of our mishpacha or one mishpacha. So do check that out. See if it can be of help. Wishing everybody a great rest of the day. God's help, we'll see you tomorrow night, live at Gulf Manor Synagogue, as we continue our study of 2 Kings chapter 23. Looking forward to that. Take care and be well. Have a good day. Shmuel Blatter signing off and thanking Jake and Mitch for all the help and sharing German.com. All best. Bye-bye now.